accepted the gift.
Wait a minute, he's taking another card out for Beckham. It's a red card.
I'm in the stand with the fans. I go with my boy, my best friend and his boy.
He gets the ball and he's gone and kicked it.
England has three consecutive penalties in the shootout. It's poor Bukayo Saka who misses the crucial one. Phil Foden and into the back of the net. And Harry Kane pulling away. England in front.
Is he looking forward to all the football?
Hello and welcome to a new series of Pro Revolution Soccer with me, Tom Williams. We're here to cover Euro 2024 from a sort of left perspective. We're going to look at football more generally through a left lens, and who knows, we may even indulge in what's known in some circles as banter while we're at it. But by that, I don't mean the sort of weird, legitimised nastiness you might get on other football podcasts, unless it's directed at people who absolutely deserve our scorn and derision. So yes, we're back. Well, I'm back anyway. The other acid football sad dad with whom I did the first season of this podcast during the Qatar World Cup, Keir Milburn. He is very busy at the moment. He's launched his own NGO. He's writing a new book. He seems to be scaling mountains and all sorts of other intellectual and wholesome things. However, you're not just going to be stuck with me, because it is my great pleasure to introduce you to a new host. She is a writer. She is a filmmaker. She is a goal machine. She is Juliet Jakes, formerly of Hawley Town, Clapton Community and Surrey. Juliet, welcome aboard. How are you? How are you feeling about football at the moment? How are you feeling about the Euros? You were at Wembley the other night. England did an excellent job, I thought, of managing expectations.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. It's nice to be here. I enjoyed the last series of acid football, and of course, you know, you and I have been comrades on the left and sharing politics and football for quite some time, so it's really great to be doing this with you. Yes, I actually live quite near Wembley Stadium, and so I go to nearly every England home game, and I was there for the game against Iceland on Friday evening. England were very, very poor. Iceland were very nicely organised, quite hard to break down, maybe should have had another goal. Some listeners may know I'm a season ticket holder at Norwich City, and Iceland are managed by former Norwich legend Orga Harida, who did a very good job of just stifling England, basically. Jude Bellingham wasn't playing, of course. You know, he's England's best player, really. And I think he has the mark of a genuinely world-class player, which is that he makes the players around him play a lot better.
He just sort of makes things happen around himself in a similar way to how Messi used to.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see if he turns out to be that good, but he's already a prodigious talent, so England missed him, but really should have had enough to beat Iceland. I mean, it's got the same population as Coventry. No, I mean, they were very poor, but, you know, big teams are often underwhelming in the run-up to major tournaments, and I'm not sure I'd really read that much into it.
What do you see happening with regard to England in the tournament itself?
I mean, I think they ought to get through the group. Mm. With 24 teams, so, you know, most of the third place teams getting through the group, there's really not that much jeopardy to the group stages, which I think is a real shame. So I'd be surprised if they didn't manage to be one of the, like, 16 least bad teams in the tournament. And then from there, I don't know. I mean, I find it quite hard to pick a winner for this tournament, actually. You know, Spain are quite a strong squad, but they don't have the same sort of distinctiveness to their sort of play or to them as a kind of group of players as they had 15 years ago. You know, Germany are the hosts, and often Germany will turn up at a tournament with what looks like quite a weak team and then perform well above expectations. You know, France have got a good set of players again. You know, they have been really reaping the benefits of centuries of colonialism under Didier Deschamps.
He's the manager of the team. I don't think there was a sort of that sentence was slightly stranger than it seemed to imply that Didier Deschamps was responsible for the year.
Personally responsible for some of the atrocities in Africa. No, I mean, I like Deschamps a lot. You know, I think Cantona was very harsh on him, just calling him a water carrier. Anyway, so I found it really hard to call a winner. I think if I had to put any money on it, I would probably go with France. But I certainly wouldn't be going with England off the back of Friday night.
I've got a feeling there's going to be some sort of tactical switch mid-tournament that will hopefully help England to sort of get past this issue that they have at left back. Certainly will have it at left back if Luke Shaw isn't fit. That will see them sort of improve as the tournament goes on and hopefully get to the latter stages.
Maybe other countries are the same and I just don't follow as closely, but England have a habit of finding their best team by accident, I think.
Happened in 1990 and Euro 96.
86 as well.
Now, you wanted to discuss Surrey v... I don't even know how to... How do you say that word?
Well, no, I mean, I went to another international game on Sunday. Surrey against the Chagos Islands. As you mentioned in the introduction, I am a former international for Surrey. I played for Surrey Women against Afghanistan 2 years ago. And so there's a kind of Surrey representative team that plays in this non-FIFA international circuit with either CONIFA, who were supposed to be having a world championship this summer that's now sadly not happening, or the World Unity Football Alliance, which I think is where Surrey and the Chagos Islands or the Chagos British Indian Ocean Territory play. And I really mentioned it partly to just sort of highlight that I was back in Surrey with my lifelong Conservative voting family and went along with my dad to this game. It's one of the nice ways that football does, you know, have a way of allowing you to maybe bridge some sort of political divides with people. But just this interesting thing of driving through the kind of parts of Surrey that you think would be very much like the Conservative heartlands in the run-up to an election and not seeing a single Tory banner, but seeing quite a few Lib Dem placards, and makes you wonder if the Lib Dems will do well or whether it's just like the Lib Dems are the ones who are vocal about being Lib Dems and the Tories are just keeping quiet. But anyway, yeah, in the run-up to an election, I thought it was sort of interesting to go back home and see that, and just being occasioned by this very entertaining game. It finished 4-2 to Surrey, seeing people still colonised by the British, because, you know, the British still have not given the Chagos British Indian Ocean Territory back, and the people who probably have been like prime movers in colonising them in Surrey. So, yeah, it's always slightly awkward. But
and also, you're actually going to be in Germany during this tournament. Presumably, you're not going over there to crack a few heads.
I mean, I'll crack as many heads as I can, but I don't think it's going to go very well for me.
No, you're not going to be slinging plastic chairs around a square.
5'8", trans woman, you know, there's talk of Serbia sending their best and brightest to deal with the English for that game. And I don't think I'd come off very well out of that. So I am going to France against Poland, having navigated UEFA's frankly atrocious ticketing system. I did manage to get a ticket for France against Poland in Dortmund, and I was very excited about this. I've always had a soft spot for the French national football team since kind of, yeah, Euro 92, really, when they had Cantona and Papin up front. Were quite an exciting side. Mm. You know, big fan of the team that won the World Cup of the Euros at the turn of the century. And even the team that lost the 2006 World Cup final on penalties with Zidane front and centre, I really enjoyed. So I've always loved the French team. Managed to get a ticket for France against Poland in Dortmund. Particularly excited about going to Dortmund, you know, famous fans with their very well-known yellow wall, really kind of, you know, overused word, but iconic stadium. And then they announced a three-year sponsorship deal with Rheinmetall, the arms manufacturers in the Ruhr, who, you know, were sending materials directly to Gaza. And there was... there was a big protest against this at the Champions League final a couple of weeks ago. It was obviously at Wembley and was Dortmund against Real Madrid. I tried to get a ticket for that as well, but I couldn't find a way through the 27,000 corporate tickets that UEFA sold. So sad, didn't get to go to the Champions League final. But much less excited about my trip to Dortmund now. It'd be nice if I could just have one thing in top level football that could just be nice and fun without it just being kind of cartoonishly evil.
Yeah, somebody that you can kind of root for without a guilty conscience would be nice, wouldn't it?
Or even just a stadium I could go to, you know.
Now, you referenced briefly there that there's a general election on. You could be forgiven for not noticing in some ways, because if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably somewhat left-leaning, and a great effort has been made on the part of Britain's political and media classes to make sure they don't have to give a toss what left-leaning people think. But there is an election on, and football is a bigger part of this election than it usually is, because there's this theory that Sunak has called it because he reckons England doing well in the Euros might help the Tories. Now, we think this is a load of old rubbish, don't we? But it's, you know, we think it's much more, I think it's much more likely that he's just been offered a better gig and he's had enough of being Prime Minister. But this does give us an opportunity to discuss the extraordinary spectacle that both Sunak and his opposite number Keir Starmer create whenever they pipe up about football.
Yeah, I mean, it's really kind of excruciating because, you know, Sunak, I think, has no interest in football, really. It's not for him. And, you know, he knows that part of the gig of being a contemporary prime minister is pretending to like it, particularly if you are a male prime minister. You know, Liz Truss, of course, famously, is one of the few people who spent more money in the Norwich City club shop than I have.
Is she a Norwich fan?
Well, I mean, she's an MP for Downham Market, is in Norfolk. So she sort of latched on to the club. I mean, I think she's from Leeds originally. So think of her as a plastic. But we've had a lot of terrible politicians supporting us. Charles Clark, Ed Balls was briefly chairman. So I had some awful, awful people. But anyway, you know, you have Rishi Sunak supporting Southampton.
Yes, for the uninitiated, I'm a Southampton supporter, and I'm still sort of coming down really after the playoff final, which was just over 2 weeks ago as we're recording this. I mean, to be honest, I don't really give a toss that he's a Southampton fan or that he kind of pretends to be a Southampton fan. I'm not sure how much time he's even spent in Southampton, despite being sort of from here, because he went to Winchester College as a child, which is, and Winchester's about 10 miles away from Southampton, but I think his family sent him there as a boarder, I think, even though it's only just up the road. So desperate were they to see the back of him, presumably. But the comprehensive school that I used to go to used to play football against Winchester College, and we would typically beat them. We'd run up double figures in every single game. But because of the sort of jolly hockey stick school spirit thing, their staff would all stand at the side of the pitch and go, Charlie, tackle that man. And sort of, it was kind of, I wonder if like the way he talks about football is a sort of like a legacy of that, really. The inability to really get the sort of lexicon of it, because it's not, like you said, it's not really for him in lots of ways. But this kind of brings us on to the theme of this episode, actually, because while we're sort of very happy to be rude about Sunak and Starmer and their attempts to sort of be one of the lads, it does kind of bring up a sort of a more serious issue, which is, you know, who gets to talk about football and who's sort of allowed to feel part of it. And obviously you've actually done quite a lot of work over the years in terms of organising work around, you know, combating homophobia and things like that in football. We couldn't really have a better person to sort of talk about it than you.
Well, that's very kind of you. Yeah, I mean, I, like a lot of people in this country, I think, became a big football fan in the wake of the 1990 World Cup and England's run to the semi-finals, you know, inspired by Paul Gascoigne, but, you know, also quite a lot of kind of quite charismatic young and maybe not so young players. But you know, from there, sort of discovered myself as a young kind of like queer, and you know, but eventually realized myself as a trans person. And so, you know, wanting to play football with boys at my school, and it was very much a boys sport at that point. You know, boys were just told to play football and girls were told to play netball, and that was it. You know, just found that I just didn't really fit in to the codes around football. And some of that was absolutely class, because I was sort of from a fairly comfortable middle class background in a school that was much more kind of like lower middle class and you know, kind of more sort of working class kids from the two estates in the town. But like, you know, I think the extent to which football is a purely working class sport has always been widely over exaggerated. You know, I sort of realised in lots of ways there was just sort of certain codes of behaviour around football, you know, fandom and football playing that were quite hard to grasp. And that me as a kind of like young kind of queer person, and lots of other people realised I was queer kind of before I did, I didn't really fit into the culture around football. And obviously as I was growing up, like Justin Fashanu was an openly gay player. Some people may know about him. Played for Norwich and Nottingham Forest quite famously in the early 80s, was black, kind of Guyanese Nigerian parents, raised in rural Norfolk, and very complicated life in lots of ways. And by the early 90s, his brother John, who was a very physical centre forward for Wimbledon and briefly for England, and also a TV host on ITV for Gladiators and things like that, overshadowed Justin, become much more of a celebrity, and disowned Justin when he came out as gay in 1990. And so when I was growing up, there was this like one famous gay footballer who had played for the club I supported, also played for Southampton very, very briefly in the early 80s. He's on loan after Clough turfed him out of Forest, partly over his sexuality. You know, he was someone of interest to me, and I vividly remember him, you know, committing suicide in 1998 after accusations of sexual assault were made against him in the States. The sort of message here was like, well, look, you know, you can't be openly gay and be part of football. You know, this sort of confirmed to me what I'd already found out through experience, that, you know, you couldn't really be a kind of readable queer person and be part of a mainstream football club.
And this is, I should say, this is presumably in spite of being one of the better players in your, well, not just in your school, in the probably in the area that you lived in. I mean, having seen you play, for those listening, Juliet is really good. It's a very natural goal scorer.
I mean, I came to football quite late, and I think if I'd started playing when I was younger, I'd have been a better player and maybe worked out how to kind of navigate some of the codes of behaviour a bit better. I mean, we're going to do an episode, I think, on the realities of actually being a football player. So maybe we'll come back to some of this there. But, you know, during my 20s, I started playing for kind of like gay football teams, and I didn't quite fit into those either. But, you know, certainly better than anywhere else. And, you know, we all started talking about Justin Fashanu, and a couple of my teammates and I decided to launch a campaign about homophobia in football, named after Justin. And after a while, we realised a few things, that we had a sort of quite kind of arts activist approach to it, and we'd be interested in sort of using football as part of these sort of like cultural sort of interventions into a discourse. And my friend Jason and I both left the campaign after the first year or two, and it ended up becoming Football v Homophobia and Football v Biphobia and Football v Transphobia, and took a sort of more like NGO type approach. But, you know, really what we're trying to do with the Justin campaign a decade after Justin's death was get people to talk about sort of Justin's life and death and think about it a bit more closely, because he has a very complicated life. You know, like, he was black, he was fostered at a very early age.
They were Bernardo's boys, weren't they?
Bernardo's home, exactly. You know, had to deal with a lot of racism. He was also born again Christian and a kind of committed Tory voter.
Right.
So politically he was very complicated as well.
We contain multitudes.
Yeah, and I really wanted to sort of get the kind of narrative away from like Justin was a gay footballer, and, you know, that was like one of the main reasons for his suicide. And it's like, well, yeah, on some level, yes, but also incredibly complicated life. And what sort of Justin's story brings up, and it's something that was quite prevalent in the 90s, I think, with the sort of life and career trajectory that in particular Paul Gascoigne took, was the sort of need for football clubs and for football culture to just take better care of its people as people. And, you know, dealing with like racism, homophobia, misogyny, all those things were like a really big part of that.
Yeah, it is still sort of worryingly prevalent, really. The season before this one that's just finished, I was at St Mary's. I was absolutely skint at the time, and my mate couldn't go, so I had his season ticket for a home game against Brighton and Hove Albion. And in the bit of St Mary's I was in, some of the Saints fans started singing "Does Your Boyfriend Know You're Here?" and a couple of other sort of homophobic chants. And then a bunch of other Saints supporters started telling them to shut up, basically. And this led to it kicking off in the stands, like with Southampton fans fighting each other. And I just remember getting home from that game and saying, and going to collect my son, who'd been nagging me by that point already to take him to a game, from my mum's house, because she was looking after him while I was at the football. And I just said to my mum, I'm not taking him at the moment. Like, not while the atmosphere is like that. It's just too toxic. It's not like the right environment for a child. I mean, thankfully, it took less than a year, really, for that to kind of completely turn around. And it is actually a nice place to go and watch football again, thankfully. But
yeah, I mean, maybe it just helps that you started winning again.
I think it helped that we started winning again. But I also think it it has helped quite a lot that the manager does seem to be a genuinely decent human being, actually.
You know, I do think in the sort of mid-2000s, there was a bit of a reckoning with football culture more generally, that, you know, the sort of 90s attempts to deal with racism in football in particular had kind of hit a bit of a ceiling. I don't think they were, you know, complete failures. I think they did open up more space for, like, people of colour to play and watch football. But, you know, there was sort of realisation that there was this, you know, just kind of right-wing pushback against it. And that tied in with the fact that football culture in general at the time, both in terms of players and supporters, was quite venal, was quite unpleasant. And, you know, I have really vivid memories of a couple of things. Like, one is, you know, reading an article in The Guardian about Sol Campbell, who moved from Tottenham to Arsenal on a free transfer in 2001. Of course, you know, very bitter, intense rivalry.
Another Tory.
Wasn't the done thing. Another Tory, exactly. And, you know, the chant that the Tottenham fans came up with about Sol Campbell, I mean, I won't repeat them, but, you know, a hell of a lot of effort had been put into condensing as much hatred towards this man as they possibly could. And again, you know, like a column in The Guardian by a father saying, you know, I took my kind of like six-year-old son to watch Tottenham and he was asking me what this song was and what the words meant. And I was just like, well, again, I just don't want to bring my child here. And I remember having similar feelings, just being like, I don't want to be at football if this is happening. Because I lived in Brighton for a long time, most of the 2000s. And so if Norwich were at Brighton, I would try and go. And at the time, Brighton had left their stadium, the Goldstone Ground in Hove, and they hadn't managed to get, it took them years to get permission to build a new stadium near the university, kind of a bit out of town. So they're playing in this converted athletic stadium called the Withdean for years. And the Withdean had a capacity of about 6,000 or 7,000. It wasn't a football ground. It was a real kind of joke.
I remember being in the away stand there and when we scored, it nearly collapsed.
Well, people kept singing "Let's all make the stand bounce," and I was like, "No, don't do that." I remember the Furiani disaster in France, so don't do that. But I could never get a ticket in the away end, so I'd be in the home end. So there'd be this bizarre thing of like being with the Brighton fans, trying to keep quiet about the fact that I was there supporting Norwich, listening to the Norwich fans like hurl homophobic abuse at the Brighton fans, and witnessing the sort of split between the Brighton fans, because there were some Brighton fans who would try and just ignore it. Some Brighton fans who were really appalled and offended by it. Some of them who'd respond with humour, like the Brighton fans would often sing "You're Too Ugly to Be Gay" as a response to the homophobic chants. And then some Brighton fans who, you know, took it as an insult and, you know, maybe homophobic themselves and, you know, got really angry about it from that perspective. So I sort of didn't know where to put myself with it, really. But yeah, I mean, one of those games, I think Russell Martin was playing for Norwich, and, you know, was a sort of Green Party supporting Buddhist vegan from Brighton, I think. And, you know, I get the feeling he might have found football culture quite hard to navigate as well.
Am I right in thinking that you know somebody who plays football with, whose dad plays football with Keir Starmer?
You are, yeah. I'm not at liberty to reveal my source. I'd play football with my friend, and my friend would say, oh, my dad played football with Keir Starmer last week. And I would say, look, can you get your dad to put in a few reducers on him?
Yeah.
Because nothing more than I'd just like to see somebody, you know, do to him what Francis Benali did to John Fashanu. And if any of you don't know what I'm talking about, look it up.
But he genuinely does like football, Starmer, doesn't he?
Yeah, he is a very keen football fan and player, Keir Starmer. And he plays five-a-side on the regular. He's an Arsenal fan. And, you know, is I think, a genuinely sincere football fan. But there's just something about his political tendency and his way of doing politics that basically means he's not allowed to sound too sincere about anything. And as a result, he just always ends up sounding like the Arsenal fan who turns up on the Fast Show just not knowing what he's talking about.
I think he's just also just such a bloodless weirdo that he finds it difficult to be sort of sincere or project any real enthusiasm about anything. And I wonder if that's partly why he's kind of been able to get away with lying through his teeth throughout his political career. You know, he doesn't get that exercised about anything in particular. He doesn't.
Well, it's partly just telling the right lies, isn't it, about the left and the lies that allow him to, you know, align the Labour Party with the kind of, you know, strategic goals of the state. But, you know, also one of the right lies to tell is that, you know, especially if you're a kind of like straight man is that you like football and that you're interested in football and that, you know, you understand the working man because football is the working man's sport. And I guess the most famous kind of example of this in recent years is David Cameron, you know, being a lifelong Aston Villa fan and then claiming to support West Ham at some speech or other in the run-up to the 2015 election. But it's something that kind of comes up in every election, right? And I think one of the functions it serves, you know, it's all part of a big kind of process of diverting policy attention away from... it's all part of diverting attention away from policy and like onto personality, I think.
Yeah, I mean, Starmer also has sort of, a month or so ago, he sort of sounded a note of caution about the introduction of an independent regulator for professional football.
Yeah, why would he do that?
Well, yeah, so, you know, he said, well, you know, we need to protect the Premier League's status as the best league in the world, and he's saying that there, you know, there might be some unintended consequences to having such a big shake-up. And I'm sure it's just, you know, I'm sure this is just a coincidence, but Starmer seems to be never out of football stadiums. If you go to his register of interests, he's been to Swansea, he has been to Crystal Palace, he has been to Norwich, he's been to the Etihad, he's been to Brighton, he's been all over the place. He must know the prawn sandwiches in hospitality at the Emirates better than he knows his children's faces at this point. I mean, this guy seems to be doing the 92, but getting the 92 to pay for it. He seems to be intent on visiting every club in the country in the corporate hospitality section. And then all of a sudden, he's sort of sounding notes of caution about the need for an independent regulator. It's a huge coincidence, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure there's no link between any of those things, Tom. And, you know, it's just paranoid far left conspiracy theory for you to draw anything together.
No, he's just a sort of like a Danny Dyer figure, but instead of looking for football's hardest bastards or whatever, he's looking for football's nicest prawn sandwich.
But yeah, I mean, it's hard not to look at Keir Starmer and just think he's kind of fraudulent, right? I mean, even if in this instance it is a subject that is very close to his heart, and he, you know, probably has got stories about going to watch Arsenal in the 80s, and he probably could tell you why, I don't know, like Arsenal bringing through like David Rocastle and Michael Thomas and Paul Davis and others at the same time as a young generation of black players would be significant or whatever, but you just wouldn't believe a word that he was saying, because he would be saying it in that kind of terrible voice.
You can't imagine him singing a football song, can you? You can't imagine him being in an away and going, what do we think of Tottenham? What do we think of shit?
I mean, you can, but you can imagine it sounding like absurdly insincere.
Yeah.
Like,
well, he's just
else.
Such a ham salad of a man that I don't think he really feels anything very deeply, which, you know, I do wonder if that's why he's able to lie with such alacrity, actually. In this, you know, he probably does like football, but he never seems very energised by it. And maybe he does sort of feel a bit of shame for all the awful, dishonest things he's done, but it's just never acute enough to really bother him over much.
Yeah, well, quite. But I think it does sort of raise questions about sort of who gets to speak, right? Because it's sort of easy to look at people like kind of Sunak or David Cameron in particular, and, you know, the kind of affect of Keir Starmer, if not the actuality of him. But, like, these sorts of questions about how, you know, sort of accumulation of knowledge and the way this is used to kind of include or exclude within football culture, right? Like, if you have no knowledge at all, you look like a fraud. And, you know, often it can be quite legitimate and fun to mock people like that. I'm thinking of the magnificent Half Man, Half Biscuit song, Rock and Roll is Full of Bad Wolves. The first verse of which is basically a kind of searing attack on, particularly on Sky TV's flagship, how would you describe it? Their kind of breakfast entertainment show, Soccer Saturday, which was co-hosted by one person who genuinely knew a lot about football and was interested in it, which was Helen Chamberlain, who's a lifelong Torquay United fan.
Soccer AM this was, wasn't it?
Soccer AM, yeah, not Soccer Saturday. Soccer Saturday is the scores thing, isn't it, with Jeff Stelling. Soccer AM was, you know, Helen Chamberlain and this kind of insufferable Aravese, Tim Lovejoy, and then lots of kind of bands who would come on and talk about how they like football. And the Half Man, Half Biscuit song is absolutely acutely observed. Like, there's a great bit where the guy from the band is sitting on a so-called soccer sofa and they're asking about his favourite footy teams, and he says that's England, Chelsea, Aki Stanley, and all the band love watching Barca. And you've got England because, you know, they want to sort of seem like they're down with the people and good patriots and all the rest of it. Aki Stanley because they're the kind of like non-league team that you would know from the Milk advert in the 90s. Chelsea because that's who people like that all support. And all the band love watching Barca because, again, that was, you know, the sort of like fashionable club. And if you wanted to look like you really knew football, people were like, oh, yeah, Barcelona, wonderful. Could watch them all day. There's a sort of moment where in the song, they ask him casually, you come from Leon C, do you ever get to Roots Hall? Which to him means fuck all. Roots Hall being the Southend United Stadium. And you know, this sort of really awkward moment that has to be broken by former Liverpool hard man, Neil Razor Ruddock, former Southampton hard man, actually.
My mum had a major crush on Neil Ruddock when he was young and handsome.
Right, well, we'll leave that. And, you know, this sort of sense that, you know, there is this sort of like terrible football culture that does exist to kind of, you know, facilitate people using football in such a way as to, you know, promote themselves without really having any feel or passion for it. But I also think there's something that happens the other way where like too much football knowledge is also kind of deeply suspect. And there are sort of cultural tropes about the kind of anorak or stato or, you know, just again, I mean, maybe it's something Keir Starmer is responding to, the idea that it's just culturally suspect to be too interested in something. And a lot of the animosity towards the quote unquote hipster and the football hipster ties into that as well. So, yeah, that's just a kind of provocation I wanted to throw back to you.
Well, yeah, I mean, so as a middle-aged, white, cishet guy, football is, you know, football is for me in a way that it... I'm made to feel welcome. It's kind of organised largely for the benefit of people like me with regard to those sort of, like, protected characteristics anyway. And for all my, you know, socialist principles and commitments, I'm the sort of person who people from marginalised groups might cross the street to avoid, frankly. You know, I'm a middle-aged white cishet man, and I'm a middle-aged white cishet man with a shaved head. I'm big, I've got a regional accent. If you're near me at football, you might think I've got quite a loud voice. I've got an adorable seven-year-old son with me these days, but I suppose that might even code me even more clearly as a cishet guy in some ways. But and before anyone writes in, I'm not saying, well, we're not saying that people who look like me shouldn't go to football and sing and shout. I suppose the point that we're trying to get at is that part of the original reason for live football becoming a mass communal thing was that football grounds were places where working class men could go to express themselves, right? Now, I'm a Marxist, and in my interpretation of Marx, certain structures have to be overcome in order to win a world free from domination. And not all of them are economic, and some of them involve confronting kind of prejudice when you see it. And I don't see why football should be something where we don't do that. Like as we said in the previous season, don't check your politics at the turnstile when you go to football. There's a class aspect to it as well, I think, increasingly, and it manifests beyond who's in the stadium too. If you look at media, one of the many occasions on which Owen Jones has been the main character on Twitter is when he's pointed out the disproportionate number of people working in media who are privately educated. Now, to some extent, I think football media was probably insulated from that imbalance to some extent by the broad disinterest of the bourgeoisie in football. It's easy to forget now that football used to be considered a bit distasteful, really, by posh people, and it wasn't really until the 1990 World Cup and the subsequent investment in stadia and whatnot that made going to football a more comfortable experience. That, and I don't really like this term because I think it's sort of meaningless, but middle-class football started getting interested in football to a point where it's almost unusual now to meet someone now who says they're not interested in it. But since then, media covering football has, I think, become increasingly, I don't know, deproletarianized. And I should say, this is not a dig at anyone individually. I can think of at least two privately educated football media types who I'd consider very dear friends, actually. You know, this is a structural issue. And when my mates, you know, people who I grew up with or played football with, or younger people who I've coached, say to me, you know, when I've recommended an article or a podcast, that they don't want to listen to somebody who went to Eton tell them about football. I don't think that's entirely illegitimate necessarily, because of course we all know that a lot of the people who get to write newspaper columns and get to talk about things on the radio or the telly are there having been in a position where they could go and make tea at the Guardian for a year or two while their parents paid for a flat in Hammersmith or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and you know, I mean, the sort of, you know, the school and class position is occasionally slightly more complicated. Like I know at least one football journalist who went to Eton but on a full scholarship. So you know, it makes it slightly harder to read. But yeah, absolutely. No, I mean I kind of agree with all of that. I spent 2 years at private school in the early 90s, and it's actually the school that Keir Starmer went to just before it became a fee-paying school in Reigate Grammar, and I left because my teachers couldn't afford my parents couldn't afford the fees. And really, by far and away, the worst part of my experience at the private school was having to play rugby rather than football, because I just absolutely hated it. And I hated the people who liked it. I'll quote my friend Katie. We were talking about rugby recently, and you know, this canard that, you know, football is a gentleman's game played by hooligans and rugby is a hooligan's game played by gentlemen. It's like, yeah, because rugby players don't need to do their hooliganism in a football in a stadium, because they, you know, used to do it all in like Africa and India. You know, all of, as a friend of mine put it, you know, watching a rugby game, she was like, yeah, all of their relatives colonized something. So, you know, there was sort of class aspect of rugby. And look, I know that's like Southeast Rugby League, and that, you know, before you all write in, like Southeast Rugby Union, sorry, before you all write in, I know the class composition of rugby union and rugby league in different parts of the UK is very, very different. But, you know, speaking of rugby union in the Southeast, I feel, you know, reasonably on sure ground slagging off rugby players from Reigate. And I think there was a sense in the maybe sort of 70s and 80s that football was something of a monoculture, and it was quite sort of exclusionary of like women, people of colour, queer people, etc. And, you know, for all the kind of negatives of a lot of the ways in which football culture changed during the 90s and 2000s, I think one of the more positive things was to make it less of a monoculture. I mean, it's interesting because something that has persisted between those two eras, we talked earlier about how Brighton are often the kind of receptacle for a lot of homophobic abuse. And it's worth thinking about how, like, various clubs from the north, but particularly the big Liverpool clubs, so Liverpool and Everton, you know, anyone who's been to see a game against Liverpool or Everton will have heard, you know, just like endless songs about poverty and unemployment.
Mm.
And one of the last games I went to before the COVID lockdown was Norwich at home to Liverpool, and I think January 2020, and got the train back to London and got chatting to two Liverpool fans. And I just like apologised on behalf of the Norwich fans for the songs about poverty and unemployment. And, you know, unlike with racist chanting or with homophobic chanting, maybe to a slightly lesser extent, there is no one in the crowd really, apart from maybe like me saying, just don't do that, don't sing that. It's far less challenged. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about tragedy chanting now.
Mm.
And, you know, when Liverpool and Manchester United play each other, you know, often some fans will exchange songs about like Heysel and Hillsborough and the Munich air crash that, you know, wiped out most of the Man United team in the late 50s. But, you know, there's no real discussion of songs about like poverty and unemployment. And it just goes to the kind of core of, you know, the success of the Thatcherite project, which is, you know, I remember a few years ago, Manchester United had a Korean midfielder called Park Ji-sung, and there was a chant about him that was both like racist and classist, and, you know, just really very, very Tory piece of songwriting all round. But, you know, there was a line about how bad it would be to be Scouse, because basically you would be very poor. And, you know, people would go on the Manchester United forums where this was being discussed and say, look, you know, if you sing this song, you are Tory. And like, shouldn't we have much more solidarity with other like working class people from the north of England? And the replies would normally be along the lines of like, no, Scouse bastards. And, you know, that would be the kind of end of the discussion about that particular issue. But it's interesting that, you know, maybe despite that, like a lot of, you know, kind of cishet like working class people still don't feel as excluded by stuff by that like that as they do from just the fact that like season tickets are exorbitantly expensive. And I guess that's, and, you know, casual match tickets are absurdly expensive and, you know, not that easy to come by for bigger clubs. So you know, ultimately it all comes down to economics. Maybe not all of it, but some
not
of it.
Not all of it. We're not being class reductionists, but yeah.
Heaven forbid.
I don't think we could, on the basis of what we've already discussed so far, I don't think anyone could really credibly level that at us. I mean, I do wonder, actually, if the idea of professional football being played largely by working class people might need a bit of challenging as well, actually, because...
I think it's always been something of a myth.
Yeah. I mean, there's a callback to Starmer here, right? You know, did his father work in a factory, or did his father actually own the factory? Because we often read about this or that footballer who's the son of a plumber or a factory worker or whatever, but because of the need to appear authentic, I wouldn't mind betting that at least a few of these players' parents actually owned the plumbing business or even owned the factory that their dad worked in.
I mean, getting into football is quite a big time commitment, and so it's time money commitment as well.
Yeah, I mean, increasingly now, because of the commitments on parents' time necessitated by kids' football, right? Because you're at a disadvantage right out of the blocks if you're from a single parent family, or if both your parents work full time, or if your family doesn't own a car, because you need somebody who when you're a child, you need somebody who can get you to and from training and games. And that's before you factor in stuff like being played with in the garden, or whether you even have a garden.
Yeah, and you know, the narratives you always hear are, you know, like very, very impoverished children who, you know, played in the street and would just play football every opportunity they got, and, you know, basically their determination just helped them kind of triumph over all adversity. And I'm sure that's true for like a fair amount of people, but I think there are a lot of football stories that really, really aren't like that. And again, maybe that's something we can come back to, you know, when we talk more about just, you know, what it actually is like to be a football player, what it means.
So we're only a few days away now from the start of the tournament. Juliet, are you excited yet? And if so, what aspects of it are you sort of excited about?
I mean, I'm not massively excited because, as you said earlier, England did a very good job of sucking any of the life out of that, in the same way that, you know, sort of analogous to Keir Starmer sucking the life out of a political movement. You know, I'm excited more about going to Germany than I am really about sort of the tournament as a whole or the prospect of watching on TV. I will watch as much of it as I can because I always do. And Saturday's game, I'm going to go and watch with my parents again. But I'll be just sort of quietly watching it. I mean, the opening group games of a tournament, I think, are always quite cagey. You know, you're far more likely to get through the group stages if you just sort of, you know, rack up a few draws than you used to be. So I'm not really expecting the opening games to provide any kind of great thrills, but I'm sure I will get into the tournament as it progresses, yeah. One of the few things I've enjoyed about this election is D. Ream coming out and banning New Labour from using Things Can Only Get Better. And, you know, it would be quite nice if somebody came out and banned anyone from using Three Lions, but it's not going to happen. So I think we're stuck with it until England win something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm suddenly imagining Starmer singing two world wars and one world cup. Doo-dah, doo-dah.
Oh, my God. I mean, England men winning something, I should say, as well, because England women, I was at the Euro final that England won in 2022, and that was wonderful. And again, you know, talking about who gets to watch football, it felt very queer. And, you know, it was this like predominantly female crowd and, you know, rainbow flags flying and things. And yeah, completely different idea of what football could be. So yeah, maybe that's something we should come back to in the forthcoming weeks as well.
Well, we can, you know, we've got all the woke stuff out of the way now, early doors, because, you know, while we're trying to channel Marx and whatnot now, if England do get as far as the semis, it'll all be enveloped by a wave of false consciousness, and I'll be channeling Tolkien instead, droning on about rolling green hills of Albion and whistling the Dambusters theme and all of that kind
of
caper.
Yeah, and the Tories will get back in on a landslide, so...
Yeah. Up the Tories, yeah. So this was the first of five episodes that we're going to be doing every week as the Euros progresses. We're going to try and get the episodes out every Wednesday. So join us again next week for more Pro Revolution Soccer.